Okay, everyone. So, let's see what questions we have tonight. I think the only thing that's absolutely certain is that there's too many of them. That's the thing which is very clear. Okay, so let's get started and see what where this gets us. Okay, my meditation practice so far has been almost entirely guided. What advice do you have for transitioning from a guided to unguided practice? I would say that once you feel that you know what you are doing, you understand the process of meditation sufficiently, you don't really need those instructions anymore. I mean, there may be many reasons why you like the guided meditation. Sometimes it may be by kind of getting into the right mood, getting started almost. Sometimes what you can do is use the guided meditation at the beginning just to get yourself going. And once the mood is there, you can kind of turn it off and you can go on your own. That might be a good way of transitioning. But really, the idea is to do whatever works for you. So if you find that the guided meditation is useful, and often in a home environment, it may be useful because of the, you don't have the same atmosphere or the same mood maybe that you have at a meditation retreat. It's easy when you get everybody coming together. You get a kind of group feeling, a group kind of support almost, when so many people sitting quietly together. Sometimes it can be very beautiful when you get that sense of, sitting together like this. So just do, really, it really comes down to whatever works for you. So whatever works is really always the best thing. Some people don't like guided meditation at all. They hate guided meditation. And if you don't like it, that's fine. You don't have to do it. In that case, don't take part in these things. Try just to remember the instructions. It is true on a retreat like this, there is not that much guidance. And I think that's kind of the idea. The idea is to give enough for you to be self-sufficient. So just try to keep those basic instructions in mind. Remember, it's very simple. Meditation is so simple. And that is the reason why often we can't do it. It's too simple. Our minds are too complicated. So just relax, enjoy. Very simple things. Have a positive attitude. Remember that this is what really matters in life. Everything else is kind of secondary. And just enjoy what is happening. Don't do anything. Enjoy the process. It's about being rather than doing meditation practice. And then, feel the atmosphere. Feel the beautiful surroundings of Jhana Grove. Get inspired by that. Very, very simple things that meditation is about. It's so simple, in fact, that is precisely why it is complicated, weirdly enough. So I'm not sure how helpful that is, but see what happens. And if you want to come back on that, please do so later on. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, so much emphasis of spiritual friend by the Buddha. What is the qualities of a spiritual friend? How should I behave to be a spiritual friend as per Buddha's expectation? Number two, you have mentioned attachment is because of self. I don't quite understand it. Please elaborate and explain. Thank you, Ajahn. Okay. Excuse me. So spiritual friendship, the main spiritual friend is the Buddha. And this is why we take the suttas, to use those as the basis both for understanding the Dhamma and also for getting inspired. The Buddha is number one. So take the Buddha as your spiritual friend. And it may sound strange. How can we have the Buddha as a spiritual friend? He died 2,500 years ago. Can't invite him for tea or anything like that. It would be nice to have the Buddha for tea. it's the point is that the suttas are there, and this is the essence of what the Buddha is all about. It's about his teachings. It's about what he bequeathed to humanity. His gift to humanity are his teachings. The Buddha didn't teach for any personal reasons. He didn't do it to gain anything personally. When you give up your sense of self, there's nothing to be gained anymore. He did it purely out of compassion to help people. So for him, from his point of view, it was just a gift to humanity. I think the Buddha would rather just go into a cave and just, chill and meditate. That's what he probably would have preferred. But, he decided to kind of give this gift to humanity. Because then he passes away, and of course, when he passes away, that's when he can really, that's when he can really relax and be at ease afterwards, because that's kind of when everything comes to an end, parinibbana after that. So take the Buddha as your spiritual friend. That's number one. The second, people who are spiritual friends, the best ones are those who have a real understanding of the Dhamma. Yeah, that's why we say the Sapurisa. Sapurisa in Pali means like the good people or the true people or the superior people. These are the people who have seen the Dhamma, who have deep insight into these teachings. You may wonder, who are these people? Well, you get a rough idea when you kind of when you look at people over a long period of time, and you know, you have people like Ajahn Brahm, who's been practicing for, you know, over 40 years as a monastic, and who has a lot of those qualities that you would expect of a real monastic, a real practitioner. That is where these are the kind of people you take as spiritual friends. But whatever they teach, whatever other people teach, it should always match with what the Buddha taught. If somebody says something which doesn't match to what the Buddha taught, well, then you have reasons to have at least a little bit of doubt. You don't have to reject it outright, but at least you have a little bit of doubt. So don't be afraid of, you know, of judging a little bit. We have to judge a little bit. That's what life is all about. Can't really avoid that. And then in this way, you find the best spiritual friends in this way. But you're right, there's also about, you know, being spiritual friends in the community as well. This is one of the reasons why we have a Buddha society, one of the reasons why we have a retreat center like this, because when you come together with like-minded people who think in the same way, who also keep precepts, also have the same interests, it's easier to kind of keep it up, because we're kind of doing it together, we're supporting each other in a sense. Yeah, so what you should do as a spiritual friend is to encourage other people to do what is right. Yeah, to live well, to do the right thing, and to help them if they're having difficulties. Yeah, so for example, if somebody is, you know, really upset about somebody, yeah, or these people, they're really bad, they're really difficult, you know, why are they so kind of so difficult to deal with? And you try to explain, well, you know, they probably have, you know, having a difficult time or whatever, life is hard for everybody. What, you know, it's just a conditioning from the past. People are like this, yeah, don't be so upset about it. This is just the way people are. It's okay, they're conditioned like that. They are the ones who have the most problems because of their own bad mindset or whatever. And then you can give rise to compassion. You can help people to see things in a different way. Or you can just be there to be an ear. Or you can take people to a good Dhamma talk. Or you can do whatever. Yeah, all of these things are being a spiritual friend. Whatever you do helps to enhance another person's life, helps them to understand more about the Dhamma, about the reality of existence, about how to be good, about the happiness that comes from kindness. All of this, this is how you are a spiritual friend. If you are helping somebody to become more pure, more kind, more generous, more whatever, you have done enormous amount of good for that person. The Buddha says, you know, about parents, he says you can never repay a parent in ordinary terms. The only way you can repay a parent in this life is if you establish them in principles of Dhamma, in kindness, in generosity, in wisdom, and these kind of things. And it's exactly the same thing with spiritual friendship. That is where it comes to her. So, okay. So attachment because of a sense of self. Why? What is going on there? And what is going on there is that the sense of self that we have, it has to have certain attributes. Yeah, what do you take to be yourself? What do you take to be your sense of self? And there will be certain characteristics of that self that is the you that you take yourself to be. Yeah, you will be awareness, for example, or you will feel that you have certain qualities. You are kind, perhaps. Yeah, this is me. This is the real me. Some days you wake up, you say you don't really feel like yourself. I don't feel like myself this morning. What does that mean? Well, all it means is that your mind state has changed slightly, and it's not the kind of mind state that you're expecting yourself to be, that you're kind of your predominant mind state. Yeah? So whenever there is the sense of self, it has certain attributes. And it's like we feel that we own those attributes. This is what is me. If those attributes change, that's why you wake up in the morning, you don't feel yourself. It feels slightly disturbing. It feels uncomfortable. Why? Because you have attached to a certain idea of who you are. These attributes that we take to be ourselves, that is what we attach to. And then that self also, beyond those basic attributes that are personal, have to do with our mind, have to do with our body, beyond that, the self also attaches to external things. Things that gives rise to happiness for that self. Like things like friends and family and pleasures that we have or ideas that we have. We attach to those because they are also the extension of the internal self that we have. The internal self goes out into the world, grafts onto those things that it sees will actually give rise to happiness for itself, because the self wants to be happy. If you have a self, you want to be happy with that. So it tries to achieve a happiness by attaching to things in the world outside, holding on to things. This is mine. I want to control that. This is my area. This is what the sense of self does. It tries to control the world precisely because it wants to gain happiness in this way. So this is the problem. Once you have a self, you have a degree, sense of identity here. That identity are the qualities inside of you attach to. And then you also take that, bring that outside as well. So attachment and self are two sides of the same coin. When there is a sense of self, you have to have attachment as a consequence. So as we reduce that sense of self, and you do that already in your meditation practice, you come here and you find that when you become peaceful, what is going on? Well, one of the things that goes on when you become peaceful is that there's less of sense of self there. There's less chattering going on inside the mind. The mind becomes peaceful. That chattering is another expression of the sense of self, often talking about things that you're supposed to do, or maybe justifying yourself, or just talking about whatever, just to kind of express itself in a certain way. The less you have of the inner conversations, the less you have of inner pictures, the more peaceful the mind is, the less there is of a sense of self. And your attachments also decrease as a consequence. You are less attached to the external world because your inner world is becoming more important as a consequence. So we are decreasing the sense of self through this practice. And one of the things that you will notice is how nice it is when the sense of self starts to disappear and becomes less. It actually feels really good. And this is where you start to understand why the Buddhist idea of non-self actually is a very beautiful one, because you're letting go of a burden, the burden of always trying to be somebody or always identifying with something which you never really can hold on to, which always is changing in ways that you don't like, and then you feel distress as a consequence. Okay, so I hope that helps. If not, once again, please come back later on. Okay, dear Ajahn, please give us any examples of conflicting ideas or teachings in Abhidhamma compared to the original suttas. Thank you, Metta. Okay, conflicting ideas of the Abhidhamma compared to the original suttas. Well, I think the first thing to realize about the Abhidhamma, it is actually quite a complex set of works. There is what we call the canonical Abhidhamma, which is like the teachings that are, part of the Tipitaka, the three baskets, the canonical, and you have the commentaries to the Abhidhamma Pitaka and the sub-commentaries, and after a while, it's a vast literature of various kind of levels and various degrees. The Abhidhamma also includes a book called the Katavattu. The Katavattu, Kata means discussion, Vattu is like the basis of discussion. And that book is basically about refuting the views of other Buddhist schools. It's all about refuting the views of other Buddhist schools. That's also part of the Abhidhamma, although it doesn't really belong to the Abhidhamma in an ordinary way. But right there in the Katavattu, I think you find straight away one of those views that conflict with the way the suttas work. According to the Katavattu, there is no intermediate state after you pass away. When you pass away, according to the orthodox Theravadan tradition, you pass away, you get reborn the very next moment. That is why the death moment becomes so important in orthodox Theravada Buddhism. Because if you get reborn straight away, then the moment you die is going to be very, very important. Because, bang, you're reborn straight away. If that last moment is bad, you're going to go to a bad destination as a consequence. But if you read the suttas carefully, there's a lot of evidence in the suttas that actually there is such a thing as an intermediate state. So it's kind of puzzling sometimes. You wonder why the the commentarial tradition decided that there is no intermediate state when the evidence actually is quite strong that there is. And it changes the kind of the dynamic, if you like, of how the dying process happens. Because if you have an intermediate state, there is, in a sense, time for the mind to, for the karma to ripen, yeah, for you to kind of have a reflect on your life and to kind of get all your karma, all the actions you have done kind of accumulated, and then that determines your rebirth, rather than having this momentary thing. And that is where the idea that the death moment is so important comes from. Once you have an intermediate state, the death moment doesn't matter so much. It is your overall karma that really matters. You can see, so there, that is a classic example of a distinction between the suttas and the commentarial, the Abhidhamma, and later Buddhism. Yeah, this is one example for that. But I think more important than actually pointing out flaws, and there are a number of other things that I could point out, but more important than that is just to understand that the idea of the Abhidhamma is actually very different from the suttas. The suttas are very pragmatic. They are about how to live. They are about how to achieve happiness. They are about how to overcome suffering. They are about how to help other people do this. Yeah, so very pragmatic, very purposeful. They have a very clear aim, getting out of samsaric existence, finding happiness in life at the very least. The Abhidhamma is a philosophical project. It's a project about dividing up reality into discrete entities, yeah, where you have so and so many different types of mind, so and so many different types of matter, and you divide it all up so you can explain the world according to kind of atomic. It's like an atomic structure. Each thing has like an atomic entity. Yeah, this you have this kind of mindset and this kind of mindset. And then it shows how all of these entities, these basic phenomena, are related to each other through causes and conditions. So this is what the Abhidhamma is about. It's more a philosophical project about showing how the world is built up and made up, and the causality that is responsible for how these various things interact with each other. So it's a very different idea from the suttas. One is pragmatic, one is philosophical. Yeah, and the Buddha always says that I have taught you these leaves, the handful of leaves, the very famous simile in the suttas from the Gosinga Grove. In the Gosinga Grove, the Buddha takes up a handful of leaves, a very famous one. Many of you will have heard this simile already. And he says to the monks, what is more, the leaves, number of leaves I have in my hand, or all the leaves in the trees, in the canopy overhead? And the monk says, you must be kidding. Yeah, no, he doesn't. The monks don't say that. The monks are really respectful to the Buddha. They don't even say that to me, you must be kidding. Yeah, so how would they say that to the Buddha? So he takes up the leaves. And of course the monks say, well, there's only a few leaves in your hand. They put, you know, 1,000 times as many leaves overhead in the canopy. And the Buddha says in exactly the same way, what I know through personal experience and what I have taught you, yeah, is like the leaves in the hand. But what I know, what I haven't taught you, yeah, is like the leaves overhead. In other words, I have realized all this other stuff. And then he says, why is it that I haven't taught you those things? Well, I have only taught you those things that lead to the end of suffering, that lead to happiness. I have not taught you all the other stuff. What would that be? That would be philosophical things. It would be maybe about the nature of reality. It might be what we might call natural science in the present day, scientific understanding of the universe, all this kind of stuff. It's irrelevant. Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't bring you to an end of suffering and bring you towards happiness. And when when you read this, you think, wow, it would be really cool to know all the other stuff, yeah? We could kind of we know more about the world, but that's precisely the problem. It's too cool. It's too interesting, yeah, to figure everything out. So the Buddha understood, no point in telling that, because you're just going to spend the rest of your life thinking about these things, trying to understand it or trying to overthrow it and then discuss it, and that's going to be kind of the what Buddhism becomes all about. And of course, lo and behold, the Buddha passes away. He said, forget about those leaves overhead. And then the Abhidhammikas come, the people who are interested in Abhidhamma, and they say, let's figure out those leaves overhead. Yeah, and then they start constructing the Abhidhamma. Yeah, Abhidhamma is about all those leaves overhead. That's the problem. And that's why so many people, good Buddhist people, spent their whole life just writing and studying the Abhidhamma. And what you know, it's not going to get you anywhere, basically. As I said yesterday, the suttas are sufficient in their own right. Put the Abhidhamma aside. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. It wasn't taught by the Buddha. It doesn't even matter if it's right or wrong. It's just irrelevant. That's the most important thing to remember. So forget about it if it's right or wrong. Already there, I think you have asked the kind of wrong question already. Actually, this is a good question. I can understand that you're interested in this, but really, it doesn't really get us very far, I think, if we even... It's just completely irrelevant. Put it to one side. That's what I recommend. I always feel it's a bit sad when I hear, like I mentioned yesterday, about all these people next door to me learning Abhidhamma, and I think, you know, why? You know, you could just learn to be kind, for goodness sake. It's difficult enough to be kind, yeah? No need to learn all this Abhidhamma stuff. But that's what happens, because we are kind of... most people have no idea what's really going on. Most people have no idea about Buddhist texts, which ones are authentic word of the Buddha, which ones are not. The reason is because of the history of Buddhism has kind of made people to see things in a certain way. Anyway, so I hope that helps a little bit. And if not, again, please come back on that one. Okay, Ajahn, one simile of the raft on crossing the river. The teaching have to be ignored from the last sentence. The teachings have to be ignored from our sentence. Okay. Basically, I'll just interpret this in my own way. So basically, don't ignore, never ignore the teachings. Yeah, this is kind of this is what I'm so concerned. You read the assembly, you think, yeah, we've got to chuck everything out and not attach to anything. Yeah, just kind of be a good Buddhist, never attach this to anything. Forget about that kind of idea. When I ever hear Buddhists say, oh, I'm a Buddhist, I shouldn't attach to anything, yeah, it's wrong already. You don't have any choice. You have to attach to things. As long as you have a sense of self, you're going to attach. So just accept that you're going to attach to things. So instead of thinking about it like that, try to change your attachments a little bit. Yeah, attach a little bit more to being virtuous and a little bit less to the worldly things. Attach more to kindness, a little bit less to kind of being successful in business or whatever. It's okay to be successful in business, no problem with that, but don't make that your main priority. Make your main priority to be kind, to be generous, to do the right thing. Yeah? Then you are on the right track. And one of the things that you have to do hold on to these teachings a little bit. They are very beautiful teachings. They are very powerful. They work. They actually do give real results. If you commit to them, if you persevere with them over a long period of time, that starts to change you. Yeah, something actually goes on here. Something very powerful goes on. And so hold on to those things, because this is where happiness is to be found. When you become a stream enter, yeah, first of all, you become a stream enter. At that point, you internalize the teachings because you see them for yourself. Of course, the moment you internalize these things, you don't have to grasp them anymore, because you know what they are from your own experience. So at that point, the grasping tends to stop. A stream entry perhaps still grasps a little bit, but certainly when you become an arahant, all grasping of the teachings are completely gone. Don't need to grasp anything anymore, because everything is 100% internalized. And that is the point. Yeah, the idea of not grasping is not so much, especially the teachings, is not a teaching about what to do, it's a teaching about the result of the practice. This is what happens when you practice in the right way. It is not a prescription for how to do the practice. If you do the practice in that way, you're going to fail. It is a result of the practice. That's really what it means. So once you get there, it will actually happen that you let go of these things. Trying to decipher this handwriting here. Okay, it's all your handwriting is almost as bad as mine. Yeah, mine is a little bit worse, but it's kind of. I have a problem. Sometimes I have written something, I can't read my own handwriting. That's really terrible. Anyway, okay, number two. Let's see if I can make sense of this one. Ah, this is actually much better. Jhana is this is this specific to Samatha meditation, or is this realizable with insight meditation too? Insight meditation, remember, these things are just words. They don't actually mean anything. There's, you know, the world is divided up into the Samatha meditation and the insight meditation, but really, these are just words that are used to describe certain meditation methods. The Buddha never talked about insight meditation, never talked about Samatha meditation. He had talked about meditation, full stop, and that was really it. So it's good for people, I think, to forget a little bit about that dichotomy as if there are two different types of meditation. There aren't. There's really only one meditation. And the meditation, which is the right meditation, is always the meditation that reduces your defilements, that brings you to better states of mind, where you have more clarity, you have more calm, you have more peace, and your defilements are going down. It doesn't matter whether you call it Vipassana or Samatha. If it works in that way, then you are on the right track. So take watching the breath, for example. Is that Vipassana or is it Samatha? It is both. It is both Vipassana and Samatha meditation. Why? Because if you watch your breath and your meditation is successful, you gain more calm, you gain more peace, which is Samatha, calm of the mind. But also you gain more clarity, you see things more clearly, and that is the Vipassana side. So any meditation that works will give you both calm and clarity and clear seeing at the same time. So whatever meditation method you use, as long as it does that, it eventually will lead you to the jhanas. Why? Because jhanas are just very profound states of calm. So if your meditation object moves you towards calm, deeper and deeper and deeper, it will eventually get you there. If your meditation object is such that it stops you from entering jhana, for example, you're saying Buddha, Buddha, Buddha all the time, there comes a point when you have to stop saying Buddha, and then you can enter jhana as a consequence. This is using a mantra kind of thing here. If you are watching the feelings in your body, it's a very common vipassana object. There comes a point when you have to stop watching those feelings in the body, otherwise you won't be able to move into jhana states because they are beyond the body. But you can use that as a starting point, and that's really the point. So all these meditations, as long as you deal with them in the right way, as long as you allow the mind to become peaceful, you allow the clarity of mind, and you continue on that path, deeper and deeper and deeper, all of these techniques will eventually lead to jhanas. They will lead to insight. They will lead to everything on the Buddhist path. One of the ways that the Vipassana meditation often is about Satipatthana practice. Satipatthana is what you find in the Satipatthana Sutta and also in the Satipatthana Sangyutta, the connected discourses on Satipatthana. And this is often called Vipassana meditation. And you do the contemplation of the body and all of these kind of things. But remember that according to the suttas, especially the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the sutta on the mindfulness of breathing, all you have to do is watch the breath. And as you watch the breath, you are fulfilling Satipatthana. You are fulfilling what is normally called Vipassana meditation. Of course, breath meditation is also about calm, but the whole thing that is Satipatthana and Vipassana is fulfilled through the breath meditation. That is the classical way it is taught in the suttas. I read a very kind of interesting article recently about this. Was a scholar who talked about how the Vipassana tradition arose in Burma. This is really a Burmese tradition, whether you do Goenka or you do Mahasi Sayadaw tradition or Ubakin and all these various traditions. They all stem from Burma, and they stem from a particular monk called Lady Sayadaw, who taught around, when did he start? Around the beginning of the 19th century, and actually slightly before that, I think back to the 19th century. And they all stem from him. And he had a method that was based in large part on the Visuddhimagga and the Abhidhamma and these kind of things, and also the suttas. And they put all of these things together. But a lot of the response, a lot of the reason why Lady Sayadaw was such a staunch Buddhist and why he was very keen on getting meditation back into Burmese society it was really a nationalistic kind of idea on his part. This was a time when the British were still in Burma, and obviously there was a lot of opposition to the British in Burma. They wanted to get rid of these, you know, these colonialists, and they wanted to be proud of their own tradition, and part of that being Buddhism. And that was a large part of where he came from. Yeah, it was a very much a nationalistic project. At least that was the argument in this article. And this is a very good scholar, so I think he probably has probably a lot of truth to that. So we have to remember that these Vipassana meditations, they arose in a certain context. Yeah, they are a certain interpretation of the suttas that are conjoined with Abhidhamma and Visuddhimagga. Yeah, remember that. This is actually what this is about. I prefer instead to go back to the suttas. Go back to the suttas and the way the Buddha explains the entire path of meditation. All you really have to do is to practice the mindfulness of breathing. That takes you from the very beginning of meditation all the way to the very end. Yeah, that is really all you require to do. And that is the fulfills all of the other things as you do that. So there are many supportive things you can do on top of that. And many of the teachings of the Buddha in the suttas are teachings, for example, on death contemplation. I'll talk a little bit about that later on. Death contemplation is really a contemplation on impermanence, on non-self as well, and suffering is actually a contemplation on all of those things. So, of course, we can do these kind of contemplations as well. And that is learning to perceive the world in a way that aligns with the Dhamma, aligns with the Buddhist teachings. And as you do that, that, of course, supports your mindfulness of breathing. It supports the rest of the path. And that is a bit like insight, yeah? Because you're gaining more clarity. You're aligning your view with the reality, what the world is actually like. Yeah? So that is a little bit like insight. And the Buddha actually recommends a number of perceptions like that. But it's more like a reflection. Yeah, there's something you can do after a good meditation practice, for example, and that supports the general movement of your meditation. Okay, so I hope that helps. If not, try again tomorrow. Okay, excuse me. Ajahn, in the last line of your notes on the simile of the snake, when you know the Dhamma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even the teachings. How does one abandon the teachings? It happens automatically, yeah? It just happens as a consequence of the practice. Nothing you have to worry about. The meaning of abandoning here, actually I should have said that because that actually is an important point. Abandoning in Buddhism does not mean that you throw out the books, yeah? You go down to the Swan River and you have all your books in a basket and you chuck them into the river. That is not what it means, yeah? Okay, I'm getting rid of my suttas now. What it means, abandoning in Buddhism, means that you give up desire and attachment towards these things. That's what it means. For example, the Buddha talks about abandoning the five khandhas, yeah, the things that cause suffering. How do you abandon those? You eliminate the craving and desire for the five khandhas. Then they are abandoned by that method. Same thing with the suttas. You abandon the your desire or your attachment to these things, then they are abandoned. But again, it happens automatically. Don't worry about it. It will happen when you kind of go far enough on the path. Could you provide some examples of real-life applications on this? Yeah, just practice really hard. Yeah, come here often, a lot. Watch your breath really well. Gain insight into the five khandhas, and bang, you become a stream enterer. Then you abandon the teachings. That's the real-life application. So see how that goes. It's good, isn't it? This is the way forward. Okay. Dear Bhante, could you please give some details as to what we should watch in the breath? Thank you. What you should watch in the breath. You don't really have to watch anything in the breath, just watch the breath, yeah? So you close your eyes. Breath going in, breath going out. Just know whether the breath is going in, know where the breath is going out. Don't have to really watch it anywhere specific. I like this idea. If you start, especially when you start out with your meditation in the beginning, when your mind is a bit restless, it's moving around a little bit, don't confine the mind too much. The classic idea is that you watch your breath on the tip of your nose or on your upper lip or something like that in this area. But You don't really have to do that. The reason why that is said is because of the interpretation of a particular word. You can see how much one word, what difference it makes. This word is called parimukka. It's found in the Anapanasati Sutta. And what does this word mean? Yeah, and you can find learned essays on the exact meaning of this word. And the traditional way is the commentary that says parimukka means here, watch here. So everybody follows that. But the evidence that parimukka actually means that from the suttas is not very strong. In fact, it's quite weak. And many people argue that what it really means is just having a sense of awareness in front of you. Yeah, you have an awareness, a general awareness in the present moment, being here in the present moment, right here, right now. And then you have an awareness of the breath. Is the breath going in? Is it going out? And as you do that, over time, your ability to watch the breath will increase. And there may very well come a point where you actually do feel the breath at your nostrils. Yeah, there comes a point when that happens. It varies a little bit from person to person. But allow that to happen automatically rather than trying to achieve it. Because if you try to achieve it, it often means using too much willpower again. So allow it just to happen by itself. Just enjoy the breathing in and the breathing out. In fact, don't even try to watch the breath too much. I would recommend just sitting back and enjoying the peace, enjoying being here, and allowing the breath to come to you. Yeah, if you think of it as allowing the breath to come to you, it means that there is no willpower involved. Instead of you going out and grasping hold of the breath, straight away there's willpower involved there. Allow it to be an absolutely natural process if you can. All you do is relax. All you do is just, you know, enjoy yourself, yeah? Don't do anything. Just allow things to be. Be very patient and see what happens. And as the mindfulness arises, the breath comes into view. Then the breath disappears again because you get carried away by something. Then the breath comes back to you. Yeah, just allow the breath to kind of come and go like that. And just see. When you are with the breath, just enjoy that. See the peace in that. See the beauty of that. And as you do that, you're conditioning your mind to enjoying the experience of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing becomes very enjoyable. Yeah, it's a natural process. Very easy, very simple. So no real need to watch anything in particular. Just go with the flow. And as you do that, that often is plenty enough to give rise to all of these things. They tend to happen by themselves, basically. Okay. Ooh, okay, long one. Dear Ajahn, thank you very much for your teachings. My question on the subject of having the right view. How does one tell if the view that one has developed is the right view? It may feel right, and the person may think he has developed the right view, not knowing he is deluded, much in the same way as how does one know what he doesn't know, I ignorant of what he does not know. One may then unintentionally cling to the wrong view, thinking it is the right view. Kindly advised, thank you. Okay. Right view only really happens when you become a stream enter. Yeah? Stream entry is like this revolution in your psychology. You see the world upside down. Not literally, but you know, metaphorically upside down. You know what I mean? Yeah, so you don't actually see things upside down. But, you know, things kind of get a completely different, you know, you see the world in a completely different light. You see what you thought was permanent is impermanent. What you thought was a self is no self. What you thought was happiness actually turns out to be suffering. What you thought was terrible actually turns out to be happiness. It's a revolution in your psychology. So to have really right view only happens at that stage. Prior to that, you are going to be deluded. Your view is only going to be an approximation to right view. Yeah, it is always only going to be approximation. How do we move forward to approximate more and more and more so that we get more and more right view? Well, part of that is precisely studying the suttas. We're going to start looking at right view perhaps tomorrow in more detail. And it's very... I think it is incredibly useful to have this idea of right view. So we're going to look at that in quite a bit of detail. But this is one of the main ways of doing this, is just to study the suttas, read what the Buddha said, and gradually that brainwashing happens. Whether you want it or not, you're going to have more right view. Yeah, And if you don't like that right view, you're still going to get it, yeah? Because actually you're going to like it. I'm pretty sure you are. If you don't like it, well, you're not going to be a Buddhist for very long. You're going to kind of move on to some other direction. So this is one of the ways. Another way that you get gradually more right view is through your meditation practice. In fact, not just the meditation practice, but through the entire practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. Because the purpose of the Noble Eightfold Path is that it's a path of purification. As you purify yourself, what you are letting go of is your desires and your ill will and all of these kind of things. These are the things that distort your mind, your outlook. One of these, with dependent origination. Dependent origination starts off with avidya. Avidya is, I think, best translated as delusion. You are deluded. You have wrong view. What is it that supports that delusion? The Buddha says the five hindrances. So if, as long as you are reducing the five hindrances, you are reducing the delusion in your mind. Whenever you feel more peaceful, whenever you feel a greater degree of clarity, whenever you feel that, you feel more settled, you feel a sense of, wow, it's so nice to have this clarity and peace in my mind, you are less deluded at that point. You have more right view. So these things go together. You have to get the right view of the Buddha through the suttas, and then you reinforce that through your meditation practice. And when these two things come together, gradually, that's where you eventually get the ignition, yeah? Bang! When you get the bang ignition, that's when you kind of get the final right view. Meditation is very deep. You attain a state of samadhi. You have read the sutta, so you have the right view, so you know where to place the mind after the samadhi experience, and then boom! Wow, yeah? And then you're kind of blissed out for 3 days afterwards or something like that. That's kind of how profound it is. So if you think you are a stream mentor but not sure, it means you're not a stream mentor. So I hope that helps. Let us go on to the next one. It's very interesting how much spiritual materialism there is in the world. People who want to be stream mentors and anagamis and people who give certificates, okay, you're an anagami now. And then you get told you're an anagami. And I heard people being told this, that I'm not an anagami. I don't believe it. Yeah, and if a teacher tells you you're an anagami, but you don't believe it, it's a sign something isn't quite right. If you really are an anagami, a non-returner, one of the very highest stages of awakening, getting very close to full awakening, you know something astonishing, powerful has happened. If you have doubts about it, you can be absolutely sure you're not an anagami or a stream mentor. You are a stream mentor. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. Okay. That is not right. Yeah, there's something wrong with that. Be careful with spiritual material. There's so much of it, and there's so much of the easy path, the easy path to awakening. Everybody wants a shortcut. Everybody wants the easy route. Be very skeptical about the easy route. The whole history of Buddhism can be summarized as a movement towards finding easier and easier routes to enlightenment. Yeah, that's what the history of Buddhism basically is like, finding this new path, this new way of doing things. The whole history is about that. So if you hear anything about that, be very skeptical. Go back to the Buddha. That's the easy path. That's the short path, the easy path, the only path, in fact. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, do you or do you think for Ajahn Brahm as well as agree with this statement? Do you or do you think for Ajahn Brahm? Okay, meditation is the main course. Sutta study is the side dish. I try very hard to be nice. Have a good night. Thank you. Okay. It's very kind of you to wish me a good night. May you have a good night as well, because then you wake up in the morning, you feel energized and ready for more suttas and more meditation. Meditation is the main course. Well, everything on the Buddhist, remember the Eightfold Path is, all of that is causes that you put in. The main course, really, are the awakening experiences. Yeah, this is really, if you really want to look at Buddhism in the big picture, it is the awakening experiences that are the main course. Meditation is just one other tool that we use to actually get us there. Of course, meditation is the main course in certain ways, in the sense that meditation gives a sense to a lot of peace and enjoyment if you get it right. So please get it right. Please enjoy it. Yeah? Don't kind of force yourself too hard on all these kind of things. So it has a lot of benefits if you get it right. And that is, in that sense, it is a part of the meal, if you like. Yeah? But it's not the main course. It's not the final kind of supreme five-star Guide Michelin. Yeah. You know, this kind of French, you know, or whatever. I'm not going to getting slightly sidetracked there. So that's not what it is. So remember, that is really the everything else on the path, the whole Eightfold Path, is really the causes that make you get to get there. Is sutta study a side dish? The sutta study is part of that course as well, yeah? And if you study the suttas in the right way, that too will make you feel happy, because it will inspire you. You will feel good about it. And whatever makes you feel happy, that is part of the course, part of the meal that you are enjoying. If you are virtuous and a good, kind person, that too will make you happy. Yeah, what does it feel like to be kind? It feels pretty good, yeah. It does for me anyway. When I'm kind, it feels good. And I'm sure many, all of you probably, at least most of you, will agree with that. If you have looked very careful at yourself, when you are kind, what it feels like, it actually feels very nice. So whenever you feel something positive like that, that's part of the meal, part of the course of Buddhism. Yeah, meditation is that. Everything is that. But the main meal, the final course, the ultimate meal at the restaurant at the end of the galaxy or end of the universe, yeah, that's quite actually a good metaphor, isn't it? The restaurant at the end of the universe. I don't know if you remember Douglas Adams, a famous English author who wrote back in the 1980s, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He had a restaurant at the end of the universe. And that is very suitable Buddhist metaphor, because we're trying to escape from the universe, from samsara. That is the final meal at the end of the universe, and then, poof, you're out of the entire universe. It's quite nice, isn't it? So that is how I see it. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for showing us the ancient road rediscovered by the Buddha. If I were a Christian, I would say you were a godsend. Okay, yes, that you might say that. Maybe you would. Maybe you said, I would be sent by the devil if I were a Christian, yeah? I'm pretending to lead people in a positive way, but it's just, you know, I don't know. Christians might say, I don't know what the Christians would say, actually. Yeah. But yes, good. But thank you anyway. It's a nice thing to say. Could you please explain this part of dependent origination? With the cessation of consciousness, there is the cessation of name and form. With the cessation of name and form, there is the cessation of consciousness. Thank you. Yes. So this is one of the most profound parts of dependent origination. This mutual conditionality between name and form and consciousness. So to understand this, what you have to understand is what these things actually refer to. And consciousness in Buddhism basically refers to our awareness, the ability to be aware, the ability to know. That is what consciousness is. You know, as you would know, Buddhism talks about the five khandhas, the five aspects of personality. And there you have the form aspect, which is like the physical aspect or the forms that you see around you. You have the feeling, which is whether something is pleasant, unpleasant or not. Perception, seeing, you know, being aware, being able to name things, being able to make sense of the world around you, perception, the will, sankhara, and then vijnana, which is the ability to know. So what the Buddha is saying here is that on the one hand, you have consciousness, the ability to be aware. On the other hand, you have all the other phenomena in your experience. Yeah. So what the Buddha is saying is that when you have consciousness, consciousness can only exist when you also have the other phenomena of experience. You cannot have consciousness without also having the other phenomena. Name and form are all the other phenomena of experience. Without these other phenomena, you cannot have consciousness. These two things are mutually supportive, like two sheaths of straw, the Buddha says. When you have two sheaths of straw like this, if you take one away, the other one falls. Take the other one away, the other one falls. They support each other, mutually supportive. That is really all it means. But this has very profound implications because the idea, of course, here is that the Buddha grew up in a certain environment in ancient India. That was an environment with certain philosophies, and the main philosophy at the time was the Vedic philosophy, the philosophy of the Brahmanical caste. And they had a philosophy that consciousness was able to stand by itself and find eternal happiness. The merger of Brahma, Atman and Brahma merging together, and all you had was a Satchit Ananda. Satchit Ananda is kind of the an expression for that final mind state that you have when you merge with Brahma. Satchit Ananda means sat is like existing, chit is mind, ananda is bliss. Yeah, so you have the existing mental bliss. That is what the idea of consciousness in the Brahmanical teachings. But then the Buddha comes along, and what the Buddha says, and this is why this is so important, he says that consciousness cannot exist like that as a separate entity. Consciousness always depends on all the other phenomena of experience for its existence. There is no such thing as consciousness without content, consciousness without experience. These things must go together. Yeah, so the Buddha then says that if you are able to eliminate all those things that you experience, consciousness too will come to an end. Yeah, consciousness comes to an end if all the other things are eliminated. So, and this is kind of the radical insight of the Buddha. Either you have both, or you have none of them. And this is how this path then is explained from the Buddha's point of view. Yeah, I hope that makes sense. It is some of the most profound things in the Buddha's teaching. There's a very beautiful discourse, if you're interested in that, called the Kacchanagotta Sutta. Find in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses, number 15. If you want to read up on that sutta, Kacchanagotta, you can have a look. It's profound, but very nice, and it shows you how in Buddhism, the middle way in Buddhism is dependent origination is the middle way. It's the middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. That's where the Buddha's teaching is all about, dependent origination. And the Buddha kind of points out how that is the case. Very interesting little sutta. But maybe on another retreat, not this one, I think. Okay, dear Ajahn Ramali, the seven factors of awakening, in our practice, do we develop these factors according to the sequence these factors are listed? Yes, these are everything in Buddhism tends to be sequential, and the same is true of the seven factors of awakening. They build on each other. And the first one is the Satisambhujanga, the mindfulness factor of awakening. Yeah, this is basically what Satipatthana practice is all about, the mindfulness of breathing and all of this. Then you have the Dhammavicaya Sambhujanga, the factor of awakening, which is the investigation of qualities or internal phenomena of your mind. Yeah, so you have mindfulness, then you learn to distinguish between those qualities in your mind that are useful for meditation and those that are not useful, those that lead you forward on the path, those that stop you from going forward. It's a final refined understanding of the mind, of defilements and these kind of things. And that allows you to get rid of the last defilements. When you start to get rid of the very last defilements, energy arises, yeah? You get the energy Sambhujanga. You get energy because when the defilements are gone, the natural state of the mind is to be energetic. It is the defilements that block us from accessing the natural energy of the mind. With that energy, you get piti. Piti Sambhujanga. The joy, yeah? The joy of the mind comes with energy. Mindfulness, joy, and energy are very, very closely related to each other. Usually you find these things arising together. Mindfulness, joy, and energy come together. From the Piti Sambhujanga, and what you are seeing here is really we're coming back to the dependent liberation sequence again. The seven factors of awakening are very close to the dependent liberation sequence that I mentioned last night. One thing leading to another. From the Piti Sambhujanga, you have the Pasaddi Sambhujanga, the tranquility factor of awakening. As you deepen your progress in meditation, you go from the fairly coarse joy to tranquility. Then from that tranquility, you get the samadhi sambhujanga. The mind starts to unify. You get real samadhi. You go into the jhanas and these kind of things. And from that, when you develop the jhanas very deeply, you get the upekkha sambhujanga, the factor of awakening, which is like the equanimity or the evenness of the mind. This is when you take samadhi to its highest limit. So there's a natural sequence here, one leading to the other one. So that is quite correct. One of the important things to remember about the Dhamma is that everything is structured in the teachings. Everything has a purpose. When the Buddha gives you five khandhas, he gives you them in a certain sequence. When he gives you the five hindrances, it is in a certain sequence. Yeah. When he talks about the bhujangas or whatever else, it's always in a certain sequence. Actually, here it's very specific because it is specifically said in the suttas that one leads to the next one. So it's very clear that that is actually the case. Okay. Majjhima Nikaya 22. Dear Arjan, in the sutta, the simile of the snake mentions was made of wrongly grasping the teaching, and I likened to grasping a snake the wrong way and suffering that brings. In the past, I practiced meditation with a lot of willpower, forceful striving for what I imagined were the goals of meditation, but I was practicing trying to annihilate what I imagined to be myself. As a result, I've eventually had a very bad mental state of anxiety and suffering and terror arising. Was that wrong practice what the Buddha meant by the wrongly grasping the teachings and wrongly grasping the dangerous snake? I mention this for the protection of others from the damage of suffering of wrong practice and striving, with much metta and gratitude. Okay, that's very good of you to mention this, because I think this is actually a very common problem, and it can lead to a lot of problems if you actually do use a lot of willpower in a meditation. So this is why I say measure the success of your practice by how you feel. Yeah, do you feel more at ease? Do you feel more calm? Do you feel less anxious? Yeah, it's supposed to make you less anxious when you get your meditation together. Not more anxious. More anxious is a bad sign. Less confused, more clarity. That is how you measure your meditation. If it gives these things, then you are on the right track, and then you are heading in the right direction. Willpower is not really going to work. I have seen people getting real mental problems, psychotic episodes, and basically, to me, it is willpower that was the cause of that. That was what, and I've seen it in monastics. Yeah, monastics getting psychotic episodes, basically coming from using too much willpower. So be very careful of that. Relax, chill, allow things to happen completely on their own. Then you are on the right track. Remember, the reason why things aren't happening on their own is not because you're not using enough willpower. Yeah, that is not the problem. The reason things aren't happening on their own is because you haven't put in the root causes for meditation to work. Not enough sila yet, not enough mental good qualities, not enough metta to the people around you, not enough understanding, not enough right view. Yeah, you've come to the right place. We're going to really, this is a kind of the right view brainwashing happening at Jhana Grove. If you don't want to be brainwashed, you better leave today, because this is going to be brainwashing galore from here all the way through. So, no, it's good brainwashing, yeah? So that's more brainwashing. It's good brainwashing. Oh, that's getting very scary. It is a very important point, and I have heard far too many scary stories about what happens with too much willpower in meditation. It's one of the things that really is problematic, and especially if the willpower is combined with defilements of the mind, so you suppress things like ill will, you suppress desires, and the kind of, you know, it becomes very messy after a while if you do that. The way to deal with ill will and desire is not to suppress it, it's to understand it in the right way and then overcome it by reflecting rightly. And I'm going to talk about this later on. Then you are dealing with it in the right way, not by suppressing it. Suppressing it just leads to all kind of mental confusion and problems if you do it that way. So thank you very much for bringing that up, because I think that is indeed a very important point. I don't think that was meant in the simile of the snake. You could argue that maybe by extension that was meant as well. I think the main point there was simply about, you know, using it for arguing and that sort of purpose, using it for selfish reasons, to enhance your ego, to enhance your sense of self. Yeah, and when you use the teaching of the Buddha for selfish reasons, to make yourself bigger or whatever, while defeating others in debate, yeah, wow, I defeated all these people because I got these really good teachings. It's like you are abusing those teachings, and that is the problem. And if you abuse something so beautiful, it's going to lead also to serious problems down the road, down the track. Okay, hello Ajahn. Thank you for your teachings. This morning you mentioned about Abhidhamma teaching in Malaysia. Okay, what is Abhidhamma teaching? Two, is it important to learn? No, please, it's not important to learn. Don't learn Abhidhamma. I shouldn't have mentioned the word Abhidhamma. As soon as I mentioned it, people get interested. Yeah, that was a big mistake. Okay. How does it differ from suttas? With respect, Mon. Okay. I talked a bit about the Abhidhamma already. The Abhidhamma teachings, basically, the ideas of the Abhidhamma, they arose starting fairly soon after the Buddha, and they developed over several centuries after that. And if you know a little bit about the history of Buddhism and the history of the various teachings, you will know there's no way that this can be the word of the Buddha, because the style is so different, all this I mentioned before. But one of the main reasons why it cannot be the word of the Buddha is because the suttas, when you look at the suttas that we have today, the four Nikayas, yeah, and you compare those four Nikayas, Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanghita Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, long, middle-length, connected, and numerical discourses, you find those suttas basically across the different traditions. We have suttas translated in Chinese language. We have suttas found in Sanskrit fragments. We have some suttas in Tibetan. We have some suttas in various other Indian dialects and languages. And when you compare them, they are pretty much the same. The main teachings are the same across the board. Yeah? So you know that this is a common ancient ancestor. There must be some ancestor that gave rise to all of these teachings in the various schools of Buddhism. When you come to the Abhidhamma, there is no such unity. The Abhidhamma of one school is very different from the Abhidhamma of other schools. So what you know from that is that the Abhidhamma teachings arose at the time when the schools had already split apart, and that's why they are different. So from that you can tell that these things actually are much later teachings. So the Abhidhamma is a systematization of the Dhamma. It's an idea, a philosophical idea, trying to make the Dhamma complete. Yeah, the monks were thinking, oh, the Buddha didn't really do a good job of this. Yeah, he didn't explain this perfectly. Well, that was where the monks went wrong. Yeah, the moment you think the Buddha didn't do a good job, that's already when you have a problem. We need to kind of tie all the loose ends. We have a complete system of philosophy. What are all the possible mental states in the world? What are all the possible physical states? How do they interact with each other? Let's write a book about that. And that's how you get that book which I told you about before, which stretches from Sydney to Melbourne. Yeah, that's that book. It's called the Patana. It's one of the seven books of the Abhidhamma. That's how big it is. And nobody has ever been able to read it because it's so long. So that tells you something about that book, yeah? And it's also the most boring book you can imagine. Incredibly boring. After kind of two paragraphs, you fall asleep. That's how boring it is. It's really, really terribly boring. And somehow this has become the idea, this has kind of become the pinnacle of Buddhism. Yeah? This is it. This is kind of the top. This is kind of the idea in Buddhist circles. So please don't even worry about the Abhidhamma. Put it to one side. It is irrelevant. Focus on the suttas. Go back to the word of the Buddha. Remember what I said before today. The Buddha himself specifically says that these teachings of his are complete. There's nothing lacking. If you add stuff, yeah, it means you can't see anything that needs to be added. So if you add something to something which doesn't need any additions, what does that mean? It means it's superfluous. At the very best, it's superfluous. Perhaps it's misleading. Yeah. But at the very best, it's superfluous. So forget about it. Leave it to one side. It's all philosophy. It's all about thinking. It's all about learning systems. It doesn't do anything to enhance you on the path. I've never met anyone who actually was able to pick up something practical from the Abhidhamma and say, I use this in my practice. Actually, maybe that's an exaggeration. But my feeling is that there's very little practical value in the Abhidhamma teachings. It's all about thinking, about systematizing things. And it doesn't really help you to be kind. It doesn't help you to overcome ill will. It doesn't help you to become a more compassionate person. And for that reason, it's not really very useful. Yes, I hope that doesn't disappoint you too much. Anyway. Okay, that is that. I'm going a little bit over time now, so if you don't want to be here, please feel free to leave at any time. Yeah, no obligation to be here, but because I have so many questions and maybe more tomorrow, it's probably good to go on a little bit longer. Okay, Pranam Swami. Pranam, what does that mean? I'm not sure Swami means, I know what that means. Okay, your talks are wonderful and full of wisdom, but if you could slow your speed, it would help to the message to sink in, rather than rush like a clear stream of water. Wait like the nightingale to sing and pause for the listeners to hear her. We shall try, but you know the problem is that very often when you are talking, you have to kind of follow your natural speed. If I don't follow my natural speed, I lose track of what I'm talking about. I'm going to start to say nonsense. So some, you can choose between nonsense and fast. That's really the choice. So maybe what I would recommend you to do, if you think it's good stuff, if you enjoy this, get the recordings afterwards. Listen to it again, yeah? Press the pause button and think, oh, okay. And restart again, yeah? That might be the best way. I shall try my best to follow what you are suggesting, but I cannot promise anything. Yeah, so let's see what happens. But thank you for the feedback anyway. It's good to get that kind of feedback. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn, kindly give us a bit more clarity on the following. Dhamma is for crossing over and not for grasping him. When the arahant, the fully awakened one, has got Dhamma as part of his life, how can he let it go? Yeah, so that's exactly the point. Yeah, you may have got that already by now, is that when it is part of you, you don't have to grasp it anymore. Grasping means holding on. It means attaching to something. It's a mental state where you cling on to something. The moment it's part of you, you don't have to grasp. It has become natural. Yeah, it is just part of who you are. It is like, you know, if you have a pair of glasses like this, I have to grasp them, otherwise they fall off. Yeah? If I go, oh, they fall off. But if I put them onto my nose like this, I don't have to grasp anymore because they become, I wouldn't say a natural part of me, but they're kind of, you know, more natural. Yeah? So it's easier. Yeah? It's exactly the same thing. Don't have to grasp when they become a natural part of you. Yeah? So that's really the point here. Yeah? So, yeah, I've talked about this a bit already. I hope you have got some clarity about that. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, please explain the four powers, the difference between the five spiritual faculties and the five mental powers. Thank you. Okay, so the four, probably what you mean, the four roads to power, that's what they were called there, the four idipadas can be translated as the four steps to spiritual power. Iddi is like spiritual power. Pada is like a step. Yeah, the four aspects, the four steps to spiritual power. And these are basically just ways, part of the samadhi practice. They have to do with samadhi, how samadhi is achieved. And there are four ways. And these four ways, one is the chanda samadhi, samadhi that arises through desire. This is the most basic one, yeah? So you sit down on your bottom, you watch your breath, and there is some degree of desire there because it takes a long time before the desire is completely abandoned. And that degree of desire, that degree of, intention that is involved in that samadhi, yeah, you're intending a little bit, that is the chanda samadhi, you're intending to move towards samadhi. Then you have the Virya Samadhi, the samadhi that comes from energy. As your meditation deepens, the energy starts to arise. Yeah, and the energy is a natural concomitant. It comes with the samadhi practice. It comes first of all mindfulness, and then it becomes stronger and stronger as your samadhi happens. That energy always comes with joy, and this kind of drives you on to the meditation object. There's a natural samadhi that comes from that. Then there is the citta samadhi. The citta is just the mind. It's just the mental, the mind becoming unified in a sense. Yeah, and as the mind becomes unified, you have the citta samadhi. And the last one is the vimamsa samadhi. Vimamsa means like investigation. So you investigate, and your investigation leads you to samadhi. Yeah, you investigate, you think about, you contemplate death, for example. And if you contemplate death in the right way, it often can make you very peaceful because you let go of things. So these are just four different ways of kind of approaching the samadhi practice. I have never really understood exactly personally how to use them in my practice. It's been a little bit unclear to me. I don't know of many people who really explain these things very clearly. Anyway, so then you have the difference between the five spiritual faculties and the five mental powers, and they are essentially just two different ways of looking at the same thing. In fact, they're not even different ways. They are almost the same way of looking at the same thing here. They only have different names. One is called five spiritual powers, one is called five spiritual faculties, but actually they are the same things. It is not clear why there are two sets. It may be for historical reasons that the Buddha started off by calling them powers and he called them faculties later on. Faculties is more common word in the suttas. The powers later on became something else. So it's not entirely clear. Consider them the same thing. There's a sutta actually that says that these things are the same thing, same things, and that's what I base it on. Okay. The noise of the bell this morning three times was too loud. Is it really disturbing for my meditation practice? Is it possible to do a more gentle ring, please? This is my view only. Thank you. Okay. It is difficult, you know. Sometimes getting these things exactly right is not always so easy. Yeah, there's for one person it's too loud, for another person it's too not loud enough, for a third person it's too average. Yeah, I after a while it becomes very, very hard. So please have compassion for the monks and the nuns when we ring the bells. We are trying our best to find the balance. And sometimes you don't know, you have this thing.